This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. Coming up at 6 on 1A+, an insider view from this year's Sundance Film Festival. Hear from the world's best-known and lesser-known directors about the movies being shown to an eager and critical crowd. Plus, the latest from the Vatican on the LGBTQ community. Now, the pandemic changed a lot of things about parenting. School closures meant many had to juggle work and remote schooling, and for a time, a lot of parents lost the help they got from support networks, like grandparents and babysitters. For a lot of parents, those expectations felt unrealistic. Our next guest says that's particularly true for mothers. And in a new book, she says that's what's expected of American, that what's expected of American mothers was already unsustainable long before COVID-19. We're listening back to that conversation now, but you can still let us know about your experience with motherhood. If you're a mom yourself, do you struggle with feelings like you have to live up to unreasonable standards? What are those standards, and where do they come from? For everyone who can better support the mothers in our personal lives and our work lives, let us know by emailing ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Jessica Gross writes a newsletter on parenting for the New York Times opinion section. Her new book is Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. And she recently talked with Central Times' Rob Ferret. Here's a listen.
You write that in the U.S., mothers in a lot of ways are on their own. And this, in a lot of ways, started for you with your experience during your first pregnancy. Can you tell us about how reality quickly steered away from some of the ideals we might see?
Sure. So I was very sick during my pregnancy with my older daughter. I had just taken a new job. I found out I was pregnant on my second day of work. And then I proceeded to get extremely sick with hyperemesis, which is extreme morning sickness. And I was so sick, I could not stay in that job. And there were very few legal protections around me, which is unusual. In other peer nations that are as wealthy as the United States, parents have a lot more structures around them, including nationalized health care, including paid leave. So I had none of those things because I live in the United States. And while I knew about the limitations of public policy for parents and had reported on some of them before I got pregnant myself, actually living through it really brought it home to me in a very real way and kind of set me off on a path to think deeply about why we make it so much harder than in other wealthy nations to raise children and what might make it better. And I think what happened with the pandemic was many, many more people realized the many ways in which our country makes it difficult to raise children. I mean, one thing we don't even think about, but is so woven into our daily lives, is simply that the school day does not match the typical workday. So starting from there, every single day for parents who need to work to support their families is a puzzle piece of hours, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, from your own experience, and you talk to other moms in the present day and read diaries from the last couple hundred years of American motherhood, it seems like in some ways the first rule of, you know, facing challenges as a mom is you don't talk publicly. You don't complain about the challenges you face as a mom. That's judged negatively. What kind of themes did you see when it came to even the ability to talk about these problems?
Well, so I absolutely adored reading these old diaries and letters because the emotions, especially around early motherhood, are eternal. So I remember most vividly a 19th century mom writing, I believe, in a letter to her sister that if she thought that she had to nurse a child for the rest of her life, she would, quote, lie down and die because she was so exhausted and she just couldn't imagine the stress and sleeplessness for ongoing forever. And they expressed the joys and the pains, but it certainly wasn't something that they would ever talk about publicly. This was all private communication, again, in diaries, in letters to only their closest intimate friends or sisters or mothers. And there's a lot of historical precedent for any time women would speak out about the difficulties they were experienced, they would get pushback. In some very disturbing cases in the mid-20th century, they were made to feel like there was something psychiatrically wrong with them. So in the sort of pronatalist push post-World War II, it was psychiatrically in vogue to tell women that if they didn't feel well during pregnancy or had doubts about their newborns, that they were neurotic and that they needed mental help. And there was, they hated their own femininity. There was something wrong with them. So throughout history, there have been moments where just simply being honest about different kinds of feelings around motherhood have really been demonized.
You'd like to think that has changed, but you're a woman, a mom, writing about these challenges in the world where the internet exists. What have you encountered?
So it's really a range. I think today, more than ever, there is space and validation for a huge range of motherhood experiences. And I've heard from so many moms who really feel that they've been saved by internet groups where women have experienced what they've gone through. And then in other ways, there's just the nastiness and the trollishness that hits every other topic. But I think the difference with especially new parents is they just feel so vulnerable. So while you might be able to brush off a troll or more easily in other aspects of your life or other life choices you might make, I think especially that new parent moment, you're so vulnerable and exhausted. I think it's harder to deal with the various streams of information that are just coming at your face from every direction on the internet.
Talking to Jessica Gross, her new book is called Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. She says the image sometimes often doesn't match up with the reality. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see if you're a mom or you know one, what do you see as some of the unrecognized challenges of being a mom in this day and age? Or if you're looking back at your own life in your era of motherhood, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or questions for our guest or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You mentioned that idea of blame. And in the World War II era, you talk about moms being blamed for the way they parented kids who had problems later, sons after coming back from World War II and having trauma from World War II. That idea that you're going to be blamed for decisions you make, I don't think that's gone away. Can you talk about some of the things you encounter in the present day?
Well, so the example I use in the book is parents fretting over what is the first milk that they introduce to their toddlers. So I have just read so many internet threads where people are like, should it be whole milk? Should it be 1%? Should I even give my child dairy? Should it be plant milk? And there's this intense feeling that this choice is both extremely consequential and that also if something goes wrong with your children's health, it will be your fault. And I just think that that's underlying many, many decisions that we make along the way, again, especially when our kids are really little, because my kids are now 6 and 10, and they make a lot of decisions for themselves that I obviously have no control over. So I think a lot of that sort of concentrated anxiety around sort of every little thing mattering so much is really around those early years.
And it seems like across the political spectrum, someone might judge a mom for working while being a mom or not using organic milk while being a mom or fill in the blank with various parts. Can we dial down the judginess? Is that part of the problem here?
I mean, I would really hope so. I think part of the problem is when these interactions are happening online, we don't have the context of each other's lives, right? I mean, certainly I've witnessed and heard about interactions in real life where people are being judged, but mostly people, I like to believe that people will just mind their own business and live and let live. And I think when you have the context of someone and their real humanity, people are not quite so quick to judge when you're just seeing this one decision that someone perhaps made without any context about who they are, or who their children is, or what their family circumstances are.
That's other people judging moms. You write that you and many other moms struggle with judging themselves. They've seen, you know, these ideals of perfect moms out there. It seems like it'd be easier said than done to just ignore all that.
Oh, yeah. I am not suggesting that it is easy or that it's even possible to shut it all out. I think what I hope people take away from the book and from listening to us chat on the radio is anytime they feel that judgment or guilt or questioning themselves, they have to feel the feeling, but they can sit with it and say, what are my values? are these somebody else's values? Do I even respect these values? Just sit and think about, why am I feeling this way, rather than having that guilt necessarily be a compass that guides them, if it isn't even something that they really deeply care about.
We're talking to Jessica Gross, who writes about parenting for the New York Times. She's with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Screaming on the Inside: The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you, your own experience, maybe during pregnancy or raising kids? What did you see as some of the biggest challenges? Did you feel supported enough as a mom? What was missing, if not? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with New York Times parenting writer Jessica Gross about her new book. It's called Screaming on the Inside: The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a mom yourself, if you're raising a kid right now or want to look back at your experience 10, 20, 30 years ago, you name it, love to hear what you saw as the biggest challenges, how you dealt with them, the places where the images and the expectations of moms didn't match up with the reality. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Gwen is with us in Madison. Gwen, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment about the loss of the support system for young families. I'm 67 years old, and when I had my children, my mother was there to help me. She she and my father stayed for the first month with my oldest one. I was clueless as to how to take care of a baby. I was the youngest in the family and never saw a baby raised. And, you know, so many young families now are separated geographically from extended family, and they don't have that ability to say, Mom, could you come over? The baby's sick. I don't know what to do. Or, an older sister or somebody. People are unprepared and unsupported, and it makes it very difficult for young families nowadays.
Gwen, thanks a lot for sharing that. Jessica, what do you think?
I completely agree. Part of the reason that we live in New York, despite the very high cost of living here, is that my parents are here. And during the pandemic, we moved in with them for part of the time. I don't know what I would have done without them. My lives and my children's lives would be so much less rich and beautiful without my parents so frequently in them. And you saw during the pandemic, anecdotally, it's more anecdotal than I've seen solid data to suggest, but I know so many people who move near family because that moment made them realize, I want to have this multi-generational life. And that's the kind of the best way to raise children in community, because I think part of the problem we have now is that even two parents, it's just not enough to meet all of the needs.
Gwen, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Jessica, something else Gwen said along the way there was, like, starting off, she didn't know how to be a mom. And I think there's sometimes an assumption, expectation, maybe a self-expectation that this is natural. So you're naturally going to know what to do during pregnancy, during early child raising, and that isn't necessarily so.
Well, what I would always say to my husband when we were brand new parents, if he would turn to me and the baby would be crying and he would say, why is she crying? What does she want? I would say, I don't know. I don't speak baby. And so I offer that to you. I did not invent that phrase. I can't remember where I got it, but it is very useful because you are learning, and every baby is different. And part of sort of the excitement and fear is you're learning about your individual baby. And so no one is an expert. I mean, certainly each child, it does get easier, but every kid is so different. You shouldn't have the idea that you're going to be an expert when you start with it, because it's something that you can only really learn through doing. And certainly caregiving for other babies is a way to practice. But once it's all you and it's 3 a.m. and there's nobody else around, you just kind of have to learn through experience.
Thanks a lot for the call, Gwen. We'll go now to Jeff in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon and Merry Christmas.
To you too.
This is a great topic to address at this time of year. My mother was a single parent, so I know the struggles of what it was like to see my mom raise kids through many ages. She had her last baby when she was 44. And from the bottom of my heart, I honestly believe as a society, it takes a village. I would like to see mothers or newborn babies receive the support they need financially from, you know, national health insurance or from our government to provide that safety net and help that people need. I would support that legislation.
Jeff, thanks for that call. Jessica, in your conclusion, you talk about some policy solutions that might help.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think exactly what the caller is saying. I mean, national health insurance would go such a long way. I have friends who have given birth both in the United States and in European context, and it is night and day. They can't even believe the benefits of the systems around them, that, you know, nurses will visit your house when you're a new mother to make sure that you're getting along okay. There's nursing support. There's mothers groups that are, you know, supported by the government. I mean, there's just so much that we don't even know that we are missing out on that really helps mothers and fathers as well feel supported in those early days. I think, you know, paid leave, again, I don't think it's realistic to expect that the United States will ever be Sweden or Norway. It's always the Scandinavian countries that we talk about with the most generous benefits, but we do so little comparatively. Even 3 months of leave, which some states do provide, would be such a huge step in the right direction. And even as I was editing the book, two more states, I believe it was Delaware and Maryland, passed leave. So I do think we're going in the right direction. Childcare is another huge problem. There just is not enough to go around. I think there's a number of ways we could fix that. I think often the solution is just more paid childcare. But if we could support parents staying home for longer, there would be less of a need for childcare, especially in those early infant days. So I think that there's a number, there's so much to be done in the American context, that, and there's any number of ways to do it, which is both exciting and also demoralizing because there's such a long way to go.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. We're talking to Jessica Gross. Her new book is called Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. Back to your calls now. Elle is with us in East Troy. Elle, thanks for calling. What did you want to share with us?
I was just wondering if she had any input on pregnancy loss. I've been pregnant many times and have lost many. And I was wondering how to not be so bitter towards the doctors that wrote me off due to a pre-existing condition that many times, and also how to be happy for people who are around me that are pregnant.
Well, thanks for the call. Do you have any thoughts for Elle, Jessica?
Well, first, I just wanted to say that I'm so sorry for all your losses. It is gut-wrenching. It is so difficult, and that there is absolutely no sugarcoating how hard and painful it is. So I think that that's just one thing to keep in mind, that it's hard, it's painful. I had a loss in between my two daughters, and it just is pretty awful to go through. So I really empathize. I think in terms of coming to a place where you can be happy for other people in your life, again, it is very challenging. I remember in my own life, I had a friend who was due around the same time as my loss, and I could not face her until after her baby was born. It just was too painful. So I think one thing to do is kind of identify for yourself what specific triggers of your pain are. So for me, it was, I just couldn't see this friend while she was pregnant. Once the baby was there, it was fine. I could, you know, get over it. I could enjoy her baby with her. I could be happy for her. But I think it's recognizing that you're, and accepting that you are going to have a mix of complicated emotions, and that that's okay. If you can't bring yourself to be really happy for someone, that's really natural, because especially if you've gone through so many losses, that weighs on you. again, I talked to many women for my book who really found solace in online communities where people had had multiple losses, because they found that unless people in their lives had experienced the exact same thing, they couldn't they could be empathetic, but they couldn't identify. They couldn't really understand that deep pain. And so that might be another way to find community and support. And there's also, you know, in-person groups. Friends of mine are in-person groups that where they discuss multiple losses. So I really hope that you find some peace, because it is so difficult.
I'll hope that helps. And thanks for being willing to share that with us, Jessica. In just our last minute or so, can you share some advice for moms who feel like, gosh, I'm falling short on what I think being a mom should be? How can they work through that a little bit?
Well, I mean, every day, just try to be kind to yourself. That might sound cheesy, but just anytime you have a self-blaming thought, think, would I say this about my best friend? If you wouldn't say it about your best friend, don't say it about yourself. And every day, again, these are sort of small changes, because often we don't have the agency to change the big things. If we must work a certain number of hours to make ends meet, you know, there are limitations to those sort of changes to our lives that we can make. However, most days I find that there's one thing that is not imperative that I do. I just don't have to do it. I think I should do it, but it is not necessary. And so if there's one thing on your plate that you can just take off every single day, try to do that, because it will bring you at least a little more time for yourself, a little more peace.
Jessica, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jessica Gross. She writes about parenting for the New York Times opinion section. She talked with Central Times Rob Ferret last month about her book, Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, if you're looking for a little order among all the chaos to start the new year, we're helping you get organized and clear the clutter with a couple of pros. Join us. Also, it's Food Friday, and we'll be delivering Chinese takeout right into your kitchen. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Now, next after the news, we'll talk with two economists about the issues surrounding Ticketmaster. This week's Senate hearing and a rare bipartisan consensus that Ticketmaster has some bad business practices. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Biden administration's directing federal agencies to ensure better protections for renters. We'll explore the impact it could have on tenants and landlords. But first, the Ticketmaster crash in November last year that kept thousands of people from accessing pre-sale tickets for Taylor Swift's upcoming tour led to a Senate hearing on Tuesday, where Ticketmaster faced bipartisan ire for hours. After Ticketmaster was accused of having a monopoly over the concert industry, politicians and music fans are now calling for immediate changes. And you can call us. Let us know what you think if you've had the Ticketmaster experience before. 1-800-642-1234. If you're a Swiftie who got shut out of seeing T-Swift, what was that like for you? 1-800-642-1234. Perhaps a Bruce Springsteen fan, or any number of other concert tickets that are going on sale this summer, and what it's like to wait in the queue only to find yourself booted again. What was it like for you? And maybe there's a good explanation here. So if you understand where Ticketmaster is coming from, 1-800-642-1234. Two economists joining us today co-wrote an article on the 40 years of Ticketmaster's history at the end of last year for The American Prospect. The title of the article is Ticketmaster's Dark History. Krista Brown is a senior policy analyst at the American Economic Liberties Project. Krista, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Maureen Tassick is a senior fellow at the American Economic Liberties Project. Maureen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And let's start with a little clarification, if we could, and I don't know who's best to tackle this, but an overview of what we've seen in terms of Live Nation and Ticketmaster, Ticketmaster and Live Nation. I have both of these apps on my phone. What's their relation to each other?
Well, you know, these are the same company. They have been for over a decade now. They merged back in 2010. And prior to that, they actually were under an exclusive agreement from the early 90s. So for the past many decades, the two have been working in tandem to consolidate the industry and create the mess that we had with Taylor Swift, and hopefully a mess that the Senate is ready to address.
So with the combining of Live Nation and Ticketmaster, there were calls that now that this company enjoined has cornered the concert-going market. And as I understand, this company has been under a consent decree. Is that correct?
They have been operating under a consent decree. This was one of the conditions of their merger in 2010, was that they agree to divest a certain some assets that ended up being sort of irrelevant, and agree to not retaliate, basically to allow competitors to access their venues without retaliating against them if they didn't use their ticketing platform. They have violated this consent decree early and often. It was not a very good document to begin with. It didn't really prevent any of the harms that advocates or opponents of the deal were warning about in 2010. And it violated it anyway. So our take on this on this monopoly is that it was a poor remedy for the anti-competitive effects of the merger to begin with, and that it didn't end up working out anyway. And we would like to see the company broken up, but.
Well, one of the reasons maybe the biggest reason this came to the attention of the Senate hearing that was held on Tuesday and received some bipartisan support for, opposition to Ticketmaster's control over the concert industry, was what happened to Taylor Swift's fans at the end of last year when they tried to get in for the upcoming Eras tour. They ended up having being shut out, getting in a queue that was thousands of people long, getting to the front of the queue, being kicked out only to have to start over again, and then only to have the general sales canceled entirely. Krista, what happened? What was going on there? Has Ticketmaster explained the problem?
They really haven't. They've used a number of excuses up to this point. You know, initially, I think they just outright blamed Taylor Swift herself for the demand and the fact that she hadn't done a tour in 4 years. So how are they to be prepared for such volume? Despite the fact that Taylor Swift came out right after saying she had been promised that they could handle it. Then they've blamed bots. They've blamed, you know, a number of different things at this point. And I think the lack of clarity in that response definitely reveals some nefarious activity on their part. But ultimately, what I think the whole ordeal highlighted is that there is no choice for the fan for where to get these tickets. And Taylor Swift herself was using a different concert promoter. She's not managed under them. And she ended up having to do all but five of her concerts at Live Nation Ticketmaster run venues. And so she could not avoid the ecosystem of their monopoly power.
Krista, go ahead.
This is Motasic. One thing I wanted to add was that there has been an incredible amount of confusion surrounding what exactly happened with the Eras tour. And like Krista said, Ticketmaster has changed its story quite a few times. Initially, they said they got 3.5 billion hits to their system, that if Taylor Swift was going to satisfy demand for her concert tickets, that she was going to have to play 900 shows. Now she had scheduled only 52. I ran the numbers, and it really seemed that actually there were probably about as many seats, 3.6 and a half, million seats in her at the shows that she scheduled to accommodate the people who signed up in the verified fan program. What was interesting was that there was a promoter, an independent promoter who's fallen on very hard times in the aftermath of this merger, named Jerry Mickelson, runs a promoter in Chicago called Jam Productions. He testified at the hearing yesterday. And while this didn't get into his verbal testimony, the written testimony includes a really simple and understandable explanation of what went wrong in the Eras Tour sale, which is that basically Ticketmaster diverted wannabe ticket buyers into this system that was much clunkier than they really need, than it really needed to be, which was, you know, select a seat system. Now, generally, if you are handling a concert that you know is going to have an extraordinary amount of demand, you can funnel the prospective buyers to get the best available ticket. And that's the kind of most rational thing to do in this, under the circumstance. Ticketmaster chose not to do that because they also, not only are they the monopoly ticket seller, they are the monopoly ticket reseller. They're the monopoly. They're the biggest scalper of tickets on the market, right? Is that right, Krista? They have the biggest secondary market.
Growing.
They make a lot more money on tickets that are sold by resellers or scalpers. They take a much larger service fee on those tickets. So that was what made fans so angry, was that even if they had signed up for this verified fan platform and waited in the queue, when they got into the queue, the first tickets that they're seeing are like, you know, $18,000 tickets. And,
what?
And you're like, well, I probably could have, you know, paid that if I'd gone the day of, you know, if I had $18,000, I wouldn't be spending, you know, my life trying to get these tickets. So
that's Maureen Tasek, senior fellow at the American Economic Liberties Project. Also joining us, Krista Brown, senior policy analyst at the American Economic Liberties Project. And you can join us as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you've had the Ticketmaster experience, or if you can see where Ticketmaster is coming from. Krista, we had Dennis, who couldn't stay with us. He called in to ask why Congress is getting involved in this. What's the purview of government in this business?
Well, you know, there are a few ways in which government gets involved with these issues. I would say Congress gets involved normally on a legislative front. So they have proposed various forms of legislation to increase transparency in the ticketing marketplace. But also there, in my mind, this hearing was to bolster support for a proper Department of Justice lawsuit, ultimately to actually, you know, break up this company. And the lawsuit has not been filed. It might not be filed, but there has been, you know, a lot of attention to the fact that they are investigating this company for monopolistic abuses. And we have laws, antitrust laws, that handle this type of illegal behavior. So Congress's attention to it and it being the first hearing this year is really a mark in the right direction.
And do we know what the effect would be if Live Nation and Ticketmaster were forced to split?
Yes. I mean, we can at least have some ideas, because they function very differently in, well, one example is in Europe, where they don't have exclusive contracts with venues over there. And it's regulated differently, but that creates a much healthier system for fair competition. And when I've spoken with European, you know, concert goers, they say that most concerts have multiple platforms ticketing the same venue, same night, and you'll be able to choose the service that you want. So if you break up Ticketmaster from Live Nation, then the two can't work in tandem to basically, you know, monetize and control the entire negotiation system, which was really highlighted in the artist testimony at the hearing, where Lawrence, the band, Clyde Lawrence, the lead singer, he talked about the fact that when you're going to a Live Nation venue, one, 100% of the time, it's ticketed by Ticketmaster, and they have all the power in the contract negotiations.
We're talking with Krista Brown and Maureen Tasek from the American Economic Liberties Project about Ticketmaster and the hearing held earlier this week with the U.S. Senate, where we found, in the rarest of times, some bipartisan support for challenging Ticketmaster's business model. But you can understand an $18,000 ticket with demand for to see Taylor Swift in concert, and when you're looking at the supply. Perhaps it's supply and demand, right? But you can also understand the need for competition and how that can benefit a consumer. And where is the competition when it comes to seeing concerts this summer? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation about Ticketmaster and their control over the concert industry, or you can email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up the conversation with Krista Brown, Senior Policy Analyst at the American Economic Liberties Project, and Maureen Tasek, a Senior Fellow at the American Economic Liberties Project. With us today to talk about Ticketmaster's control over the concert business and what choice bands and their fans have when going to see a show. Our guest recently wrote an article for the American Prospect called Ticketmaster's Dark History. And we want to know what you think at 1-800-642-1234. Do you think Ticketmaster's running a monopoly? You think it's fair? You think it's fun trying to get tickets for his summer concerts? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. Do you understand the predicament that Ticketmaster faces in terms of supply and demand? I return to our guests here, Maureen Tasek and Krista Brown, and ask you both, what happened to Pearl Jam? Last time, I believe one of the last times that Ticketmaster was facing scrutiny from the Department of Justice, from the government, was in the mid-90s, about the time that Pearl Jam was trying to develop a competitor to Ticketmaster. What happened?
Well, essentially, Pearl Jam wasn't, they were a really successful band. They made a lot of money selling CDs, and they didn't really need to. They were very anti-consumerist, and their feeling was that if they were going to promote their CDs, they were going to do it by giving live shows, doing charity events, doing free shows. And that required them to do a little bit of negotiation. They were really dedicated to the idea that anybody, any kid ought to be able to afford to come and see them play live. And so they started trying to negotiate with their venues and with their concert promoters at the time. And they, you know, had some luck at negotiating a break on a convenience fee here, a break on a service fee here. But they kept hitting a wall at the last minute. You know, they would have the ticketing machines in one of their venues all shut down. You know, that somebody would come back and renege, and eventually they hit a wall. And as it turned out, Ticketmaster had told the North American Concert Promoters Association, who were kind of the trade organization of the big rock promoters in America at the time, that there would be no negotiation with Ticketmaster. We're not playing ball. We've got to keep our exclusives. Don't give them a break. They were trying to get the ticket, the convenience fee down to $2. And Ticketmaster, it wasn't like they couldn't do it. It's not like they couldn't afford to do their job with a $2 convenience fee. They just didn't want to set any sort of precedent. They thought Ticketmaster, that Pearl Jam was getting a little bit too big for its britches. So Pearl Jam suddenly finds itself in the position where they're having a really hard time planning their tour. And Kurt Cobain killed himself, and they happened to be in town in Washington, D.C. for some, maybe perhaps another fundraiser. They did a lot of fundraisers for the Democrats and Bill Clinton at the time. And they start talking about maybe this is an antitrust case. Maybe we should really start, you know, try to go up against this company. Obviously, a lot of smaller bands, a lot of smaller rock promoters had problems with Ticketmaster in the past. So they hired some lawyers and drafted a complaint that they submitted to the Department of Justice, which was the impetus for the Department of Justice launching a formal antitrust investigation into Ticketmaster. And as part of that, the House Oversight Committee, it was called the Investigations Committee at the time, held a hearing where Pearl Jam came and some rock historians came and some concert promoters came. REM's manager came, Aerosmith's manager came, and they all testified as to how Ticketmaster had sort of established this monopoly and how they had gotten sort of unilateral control over the ticketing market and over the fees that they were, the convenience charges that they were allowed to charge. So basically, at this point, what we realized when we started digging into the history is that Ticketmaster's monopoly over and their control over the world of live music really goes back a long way, and there, you know, needs to be there needs to be a thorough investigation, because that one back in the 90s was sort of abruptly cut short after a sort of Faustian bargain that the Democrats made with the Republicans after they ascended to power in Congress and the Senate.
And that was before Ticketmaster had Live Nation as part of its company and further cornering the market on some of these concerts, venues, and promotions. Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234 about your ticketing experiences. We'll start with John in Stoddard. Good afternoon, John.
Yeah, I want to expand what you're touching on. About 3 years ago, the Green Bay Packers sold out ticketing to Ticketmaster. Before that, they had their own. You remember, that's the third largest stadium, I think, in football. And you just got in the mail. I'm a season holder, also an owner of the Packers. We got these paper tickets. We sent them out. Took about half an hour to disperse your entire season. I've spent as many as 2 hours trying to transfer a single ticket. Ticketmaster is so bogged down. And then a password will slip, and you have to start, and you have to call this number and wait until they can help you. So it goes beyond the concerts. They've gotten into professional sports, too.
I appreciate you bringing up the Packer fans, John. And Krista, how far does Ticketmaster want to grow and expand? What are they looking at next if the Green Bay Packers are now part of their purview?
Yeah, well, it's funny bringing up music because that was actually – or, sorry, sports, because that was actually something – that the Jam Productions testimony really highlighted, that they own 93% of the NFL venues and contracts and or have exclusivity over them, and 87 of the NBA, 80-something of NHL. So they have, you know, almost complete control of that whole sports industry as well.
Matt from Madison emailed us ideas@WPR.org and pointed to a concert in Chicago where everybody had to pick up their tickets at will call. Everybody had to show their name and ID and pick up the tickets that they were purchasing, that they had purchased, so that there was no secondary market for these tickets. Is that a possible solution moving forward?
I think that there are a number of possible solutions to this problem, especially if for, you know, rationally there should be, intellectually there should be a number of possible solutions. In fact, Taylor Swift had a really unique program during her 2018 tour, where she actually, because she was so passionately devoted to the notion that her most passionate fans should get first preference, first crack at the tickets, she developed this funny point system where you could do little activities like, you know, write a review of a YouTube video, or, you know, write a Tumblr post about Taylor Swift, or buy a CD and amass more points that would get you a better place in the queue, right? This worked well as far as from my understanding of the Swiftie universe. This worked very well to get the, you know, at least for the most passionate Taylor Swift fans. But this program was abandoned. And I do think that your options when you are dealing with Ticketmaster are relatively limited. Coming to the, in the sports fan universe, I am an Eagles fan. But we live in Washington, D.C., so we're not season ticket holders. But we've heard some reports that a few season ticket holders were not even able to get playoff tickets, and that those tickets were another, it was another case where those playoff tickets were immediately going for $20,000, which is just kind of obscene. So, you know, the Eagles are not an organization like the Packers where there's a community ownership, I'm sad to say, but it is really a sad statement if it's that hard for a Packers owner fan to get tickets.
And we are out of time, but Maureen Tazik, I want to thank you for joining us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Krista Brown, thank you to you as well. Krista Brown, Senior Policy Analyst at the American Economic Liberties Project. Maureen Tasek, a Senior Fellow at the American Economic Liberties Project, joining us today to talk about the Senate hearing on Tuesday for Ticketmaster and the monopoly the organization has on selling concert tickets and promotion. Coming up after the news, we'll learn more about the Biden administration's efforts to step up protections for renters and what kind of impact that could have. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.